You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. La Belle Époque. To mark artistic director Nicolas Ghesquiere's first decade at Louis Vuitton, Vanity Fair explores the house archive with a little help from the Higham sisters by Keziah Weir. Photographs by Norman Jean Roy, styled by Deborah Afshani. In the photos, the Wayback Machine, Ghesquiere's trunk dress from fall-winter 2024, the Petite Malle, an instant it bag introduced in 2014 and inspired by Albert Kahn's trunks. Kahn's 1929 photography trunk, one of LV's early custom projects. And in the opening photo, Days Are Gone, rock trio Danielle, Este, and Alana Higham in Louis Vuitton looks from spring-summer 2015, cruise 2016, and spring-summer 2020. On the outskirts of Paris, in an undisclosed location, sits a building that puts the most opulent closets to shame. Inside, it houses some 50,000 Louis Vuitton archival items, plus another 200,000 pieces of documents and ephemera. There are hand-beaded gowns, the lace angel wings worn by models in Virgil Abloh's posthumous fall-winter 2022 show, sunglasses labeled like insect specimens, stacks of stilettos and sneakers, 19th-century luggage designed and produced by the brand's eponymous founder, bearing the soft patina of travel and time. Not many people enter the storage facility, and those who do often suit up like surgeons. Much of the vast collection comprises organic materials, wood, leather, goods, textiles, ivory, graphic arts. So the sensitive archives are kept a cool 18 to 20 degrees Celsius with 55% humidity. Aurélie Samuel, Vuitton's art, culture, and patrimony director, says that the archives serve for the designers, currently Nicolas Ghesquiere and Pharrell Williams, as a daily source of inspiration. There is perhaps no designer more entranced by the boggy quagmire of time than Ghesquiere, who has, over his decade-plus tenure at the helm of women's wear, produced an oeuvre that constantly doubles back on itself to emerge anew, plumbing not only his own past creative efforts, but the depths of Vuitton's history to work and rework concepts of self-presentation. At a moment when many major fashion houses have been undergoing changes to their creative direction, Gucci, Valentino, Chanel, Chloe, Alexander McQueen, and Givenchy, to name just a few, Ghesquiere's lengthy term is all the more significant. He arrived at Vuitton labeled a futurist. "But you know the future is now for me," he told Ingrid Sishi in a 2014 interview for this magazine, his first after he was announced for the role. 6 years later, when I spoke to him for a mid-pandemic profile, he told me that he had become increasingly interested in history. No surprise, maybe, when at Vuitton he's so steeped in it. "My inspiration has been extended," he said, "because I'm okay to explore past, present, and future." Este, Danielle, and Alana Higham, the trio of 30-something sisters who are the rock band Higham, known for their intimate, ebullient love songs and music videos, often directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, in which they stride through the streets of Los Angeles, have been following Ghesquiere's trajectory since they were teens in the Valley, rifling through magazines and tearing out Balenciaga ads. They released their first album a little more than a month before Ghesquiere joined Vuitton. On a four-way video call, the sisters beaming in from their respective sun-soaked L.A. homes, Este calls Gasquer an oracle. Danielle describes his aesthetic as lived in, but structured and cool. When I mention that the descriptor isn't a bad fit for Haim's folky, exuberantly danceable sound, she continues, we've always just been such fans, with clothing, with music, of taking so much inspiration from the past, but hopefully making something that looks new again. While preparing for their long-awaited One More Haim tour for their album Women in Music Part 3 and in the market for an outfit, normally on our tours we would just wear what was in our suitcases, but with this one we really wanted a uniform, Alana says. They fell in love with a pair of black leather pants from Vuitton's Fall-Winter 2022 women's collection. Buttery and buckled with a high waist silhouette. There's nothing short of high kicks happening on stage, says Este, and I think the big question was, can we do these high kicks in these leather pants? And the answer is yes. We actually found out later that we are the only ones that have the pants, Alana says. After the runway sample, Louis Vuitton produced only 3 pairs to the sisters' measurements. They topped them with black bralettes, also by Vuitton, and performed, they say, more than 60 shows in them, from Las Vegas to London, where they were joined by their good pal Taylor Swift, plunderer of past lives and layer of Easter eggs, for a mashup of their song Gasoline with her love story. She, too, donned the leather pants. We have the 3, and there's one in existence that she wore, Alana says. The sisters still own their pairs. The 4th is back in the Vuitton archive. All major fashion houses catalog their past, amassing a repository of brand codes and bygone collections. But for Vuitton, historically a trunk maker that only expanded into fashion in 1997, the archive is of particular relevance. It is a fashion brand that emerged from the beautiful rubble of its history. In the mid-1830s, it took the teenage Louis Vuitton 2 years and nearly 300 miles on foot to travel from his childhood home in Ancay, France, to Paris. There, he apprenticed with a master boxmaker, began working for the Empress, and in 1854 created the company that would bear his name for many years to come. The brand's rise coincided with that of the 20th century travel boom. People wanted to discover the world, to learn from the other, from the outside country, from the foreigners, the archivist Samuel says. So they began to think about great expeditions. Vuitton created luggage to accompany these travels, but the family were self-mythologizers and collectors, too. Louis' son Georges created the iconic linked LV monogram, and his son, Gaston Louis, gravitated toward antique trunks and objets related to travel. Many fashion houses began to seriously consider the preservation of their archives in the 1980s, when the rise of fast fashion and industrialized techniques created a looming fear of loss. It was at this moment that everybody has discovered that the know-how, the savoir-faire, is important to preserve because it has begun to disappear, Samuel says. With Gaston Louis, the Vuitton archive had a significant head start. And already, the past had long served as inspiration. In the 1900s, Louis Vuitton began to produce flaconniers, small cases with structured compartments designed to hold perfume bottles. In the 1920s, the house released its first scents. The first idea was to pack perfume, says Samuel, and then we made perfume. In this year's fall-winter collection, marking 10 years designing for the brand, Gasquer unleashed a whirlwind of the time warped and revisited. Not only riffing on motifs from his own past collections, but actually printing images of historic trunks, including a 1924 automobile trunk used by Citroën, onto silk and cotton to create sculptural trompe-l'oeil dresses. and on the modern silhouettes of new handbags. In his very first Vuitton collection, Gesquer shrunk archival trunks, including a custom one made for the 19th century banker and philanthropist Albert Kahn, into adorably tiny boxy purses. The iconic Petit Malle that remains one of Vuitton's best-known bags. Besides its recognizable shape, the classic Petit Malle is distinguished by three stylized X's that appear on its corner, Kahn's personalization for his own trunks. Here, the snake again eats its tail, because back in 1912, Kahn embarked on an impossible venture of his own. He wished to document the entire world, a kind of photographic inventory of the surface of the globe, occupied and organized by man, such as it presents itself at the beginning of the 20th century, in the utopian hope that knowledge would promote a better understanding between cultures. He dubbed the 19-year project Les Archives de la Planète. Dipping into his deep coffers, Kahn deployed nearly 15 photographers, making use of the Lumière brothers' new techniques in color imagery to produce a mind-bending 72,000 autochromes, a process requiring beakers of chemicals and fragile glass plates, prime cargo for Vuitton's packing prowess. The project came to an end in the wake of the 1929 Wall Street crash, but thanks in part to the protective casings of Vuitton luggage, the fruits of his labor live on in the Musée Départemental Albert Kahn and its online archive. A rug maker works a loom in Algier. Soldiers await warfare at Le Hamal. A woman splits a betel leaf in Hanoi. Horse-drawn carriages pause outside the New York Public Library. There is a wistfulness to any project that seeks to fight the losing battle against time. Objects stripped of context, images of vanished moments. Vuitton is only too aware of the precarity of holding on to the past. Their master perfumer, Jacques Cavalier-Beltrude, has described a 1950s fire that destroyed records of those first perfume formulations. Scent memories going up in smoke. As Jacques Derrida wrote, there would be no desire to archive without life's radical finitude, the inevitability of loss. Never forget that what becomes timeless was once truly new, Gesquer wrote Sichy 10 years ago. Or as Samuel puts it, when Louis Vuitton created the first trunk, or the monogram for Georges, it was contemporary, and today it's heritage. Today's creation is tomorrow's heritage. There is a tender democratization that occurs, too, when a simple Pyrex beaker is treated with as much care as a trio of Yayoi Kusama polka dot bikini bottoms, or the brittle pages of a ledger begun in 1910, marking Kahn's purchases. A few small trunks, a hold-all bag, two flaconniers, and several cashmere throws and scarves. They have all, for now, been saved from oblivion. Empire State of Mind. Can Steve Bannon and his army of malcontents succeed at upsetting the American-led global order? By James Pogue. With opening illustration of Steve Bannon by Edward Kinsella III. And in the illustration, Bannon looks directly at the viewer, a very dark expression on his face, with an even darker background. And the listener must remember that this article went to press before the 2024 elections. There are times when Washington still feels like what it used to be, a sleepy little southern city. Generations of some of the most powerful people on earth have spent their days in D.C., griping that the city is a backwater. But Washington's modest position in our constellation of great cities was always part of its charm, well suited to our sprawling continental republic. American power has no center, or rather, it has centers all over. New York for finance, Houston for energy, the low-slung hubs of Menlo Park, and Atherton, California for tech, all the way back to the elite schools of New England, where our scribes and aristocrats are trained to manage the subsystems that keep the American project functioning. America, as many of the most powerful people in the world now fret, may suddenly feel like the Roman Empire entering its age of chaos and decline. But America has never had a Rome. The D.C. area has grown immensely in population, wealth, and importance since the end of the Cold War. Its new status as the capital of a free-spending and unchallenged global hegemon made the region into one of the world's richest metro areas. Washington now even boasts an infrastructure befitting its position as the administrative center of an empire. As the casual phrasing among policy elites now often puts it, one that depends as much on flows of money and information as it does on raw military force. A cluster of cables and data centers in Northern Virginia now funnel a huge majority of global internet traffic through unassuming exurbs like Tyson's Corner, where communications can be conveniently monitored by the experts at the National Security Administration. But this past July, Washington felt barely prepared to host an event like the 75th anniversary summit of NATO. The city was in the grip of two kinds of heat. The first was a dome of breezeless humidity and 100-degree days that made even a short walk torturous. The second was the heat that would soon burst forth to make that month into what may be remembered as the most dramatic and consequential in our contemporary political history. But the news of one president being nearly assassinated and another perhaps withdrawing from the race were just the most visible tremors of a geologic shift that was unsettling a system upheld by the most successful alliance in history, as NATO's trim Norwegian Secretary General described it. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, NATO's leaders stood in almost perfect unison, saying the American-led apparatus that had given Washington its new wealth and importance was facing an existential risk. It was the great battle for freedom, President Joe Biden said, a battle between democracy and autocracy, between liberty and repression, between a rules-based order and one governed by brute force. The theme of this year's meeting was unity and standing up to a challenge to America's ability to set the rules governing security and stability around the world. But just a short, sweaty walk from the summit, a surreal D.C. split screen, as one Politico reporter described it, was unfolding at the Capitol Hilton, where insurgents and critics of this system were speaking at the National Conservatism Conference, NatCon. The foreign policy buzzword was multipolarity. a dry-sounding term, but one that hints at an epochal shift away from a world where America and its allies are able to control practically all financial, military, and technological structures. Policymakers in Washington were looking to China and talking in terms approaching panic about how unprepared America was for a new era of great power conflict. Ukrainian troops would soon be outnumbered 5-1 on parts of the Donbas front. As the leaders and delegations of 32 member nations began arriving at Andrews Air Force Base, dread was growing that half of America's electorate was lining up behind an America First movement that had embraced this multipolar vision as one that would benefit regular Americans at home. Even if it saw us lose our overwhelming power abroad, war was already raging at the periphery of the empire, but the more pressing fear was that America might soon have a government run by people who wanted to unmake it from within. Unity, resolve, purpose, all that good stuff, one highly placed European delegate said to me in a private aside, that's what the show's for. But obviously there is this gigantic question mark hanging over the whole thing about what's going to happen in November. The night before the summit began, I had a drink at the old Ebbett Grill, in view of the White House, with a friend who works for a defense contractor. This feels crazy, she said, meaning the frenzied mood suffusing the town. Everyone is so keyed up, it feels like they're going to snap. But this wasn't just a vibe, it was a response to a very real chance that a shock could come to the whole world order. I think people don't fully appreciate that the institutions literally couldn't function. Ben Rhodes, who had been President Barack Obama's most important advisor on foreign policy, told me later. He said the world is two-thirds of the way to a new world war, but a shock could come even without that. The G20, IMF, World Bank, NATO, it's not that the U.S. is the biggest stakeholder, he went on. They're literally appendages of the United States and our interest and our system. When we act as a disruptor of our own empire, the system gets thrown completely out of whack. This is what populism, coming from left or right, really means. It's when voters get to weigh in on subjects that politicians and policy experts like to keep outside the realm of public debate. This may sound like simple democracy, but in practice, it's not how democracies within the core of the American system, from France to Japan to our own, actually work. The politicians, business titans, and heads of think tanks who set policies for these democracies tend to fear, with some fairness, that if voters get too much of a say on matters of statecraft, they'll throw whole societies into chaos. The first great disruption of this era came in 2016, the year of the Brexit vote, when UK Prime Minister David Cameron called a referendum on Britain's membership in the European Union, confident that the side representing integration, a global and interconnected future, progress itself, would easily win. He was hoping to settle an internal conflict in his Conservative Party between technocratic liberals like himself and a wing of traditionalist dons and nationalist backbenchers. Instead, he lost and stepped down. Brexit brought stature to an ex-traitor named Nigel Farage, who until then had been the gadfly leader of the fringe UK Independence Party, serving in a mostly symbolic role as a member of the European Parliament he wanted to abolish. "When I came here 17 years ago, you all laughed at me," he told a jeering crowd of fellow EU parliamentarians after the vote. "You're not laughing now, are you?" Farage is close friends with Stephen K. Bannon, the single person who has done the most to throw these big systemic questions into the maelstrom of Western public debate. When I got to the NATO summit, Bannon had just headed off to serve a 4-month federal prison sentence for contempt of Congress. but Bannon has turned his immensely influential War Room show, which has continued to broadcast after his incarceration with guest host, into a cross between a daily troop muster and a policy training school, which he uses to tutor millions of peasants, as he likes to phrase his target demographic, on how this global power structure actually functions. He has made it both a mission and a business to illuminate the link between capital markets and geopolitics, as one show focus has it, and the workings of what he calls the dollar empire. Farage has said that without Bannon, whose Breitbart London was loudly supportive of the effort, I'm not sure we would have had a Brexit. The Brexit vote was often portrayed in international media as the product of a single-minded backlash to an era of rapid immigration, which radically changed the ethnic makeup of cities across Britain and made London the world's most diverse capital. Though true, this was only part of the picture. For many voters, and for Vote Leave campaigners like the Bentley-driving son of a Baron Jacob Rees-Mogg, who presents more like a character out of a Thackeray novel than as a modern politician, resistance to mass immigration is only one facet of a worldview that runs in almost direct contravention to the one that has spurred the development of the American-led unipolar world. The best outsider's portrait of Bannon is a book by the ethnographer Benjamin Teitelbaum called War for Eternity, Inside Bannon's Far-Right Circle of Global Power Brokers. Teitelbaum spent years interviewing Bannon and his like-minded allies and associates, from the late Brazilian far-right guru Olavo de Carvalho, as the New York Times described him, to Alexander Dugin, the philosopher who was, in the years before Russia launched its shadow takeover of Crimea and parts of eastern Ukraine, one of Russia's most prominent public intellectuals, in posh hotel rooms and under-the-radar gatherings. He got unparalleled access to Bannon, and he was able to do so in part because he came to him not as a political reporter, but as a scholar, interested in an obscure school of thought known as traditionalism. Capital T traditionalism is a mystical philosophy developed by a Frenchman named René Guénon, who converted to Islam and died in Cairo in 1951. His syncretic view held that modern ideologies like liberalism and communism had perverted the natural, sacred, timeless, true order of human life. Many inheritors adapted and expanded Guénon's philosophy, most notably the Italian Julius Evola, for whom the natural order of things meant men ruled over women and whites and Aryans were above black, Jewish, and Arab people. Evola used his theories to elaborate a meta-narrative of why nations and empires rise and fall. A small addition to a library of esoteric historiography that now makes for popular fodder in conservative circles. Traditionalists aspire to be everything modernity is not, Teitelbaum wrote, to commune with what they believe are timeless, transcendent truths and lifestyles, rather than to pursue progress. Bannon first encountered traditionalism in his 20s, when he secretly practiced meditation and frequented mystical bookstores while serving on the Navy destroyer USS Paul F. Foster. Teitelbaum does not try to pin Bannon as a devotee, although some people on today's far right certainly are. The word that best describes Bannon, in quite a few senses, is restless. He's a compulsive reader with an ideology that owes more to his own experience and sense of loyalty to legacy Americans, as one Bannon employee puts it to me, than to any one philosophy. But as he followed a path into the American elite, from a working-class kid who grew his hair long and lived in a tent while attending Virginia Tech to founding his own Beverly Hills investment firm, Bannon kept up his mystical studies and developed an outlook that shared much with a small-t traditionalist backlash, against the financialized and tech-dominated world that was emerging. He saw the aristocrats around him as a deadened people, hopelessly disconnected from the blood and sweat and deep sense of shared spiritual purpose that had made America into a great nation. When he arrived at Goldman Sachs to work in mergers and acquisitions, he discovered he was the only member of his cohort of hires who'd come from a blue-collar background or had served in the military. "The aristos don't fight," he told Teitelbaum. "They strictly don't." Bannon developed relationships with traditionalist-minded critics of the global system all over the world, from former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro to Hungary's Viktor Orban. Some of them, like the openly traditionalist philosopher Dugin, have been deeply antagonistic to America. Bannon and Dugin are hardly allies, even if Dugin welcomes the idea that a nationalist America might rise up alongside the solar Russia he dreams of, borrowing an idea from Evola. But they share an intuitive sense of the tradition, as Bannon said when the two met in 2018. More importantly, Bannon and populists throughout the West came to welcome the vision, now Russia's guiding policy, of a multipolar world order that will rise in place of the American-led order, which Bannon had come to believe was ravaging Americans. "America isn't an idea," he told Dugin. "It is a country. It is a people with roots, spirit, destiny," he said. "And what you're talking about, the liberalism and the globalism, real American people are the victims of that. We're talking about the backbone of American society, the people who give the country its spirit. They're not modernist. They're not the ones blowing trillions of dollars trying to impose democracy on places that don't want it. They're not the ones trying to create a world without borders. They're getting screwed in all this by an elite that doesn't care about them and that isn't them." In August 2019, Bannon released an interview with Farage in which he spoke to a mystery that hangs over much of the upheaval in the world order today. Why it's the right, and not the traditional critics on the left, who suddenly present the biggest threat to the global world order. "The reason is the immigration. They're not prepared to take it on," he said about left populist figures like Bernie Sanders, and then UK Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. "We're prepared to take it on. It's a global revolt. It's a zeitgeist." To Bannon, and for pretty much everyone involved in his diffuse movement, resisting the empire is bound up in a project of preserving the spiritual character of a nation. "And there was another thing," he later talked to me about at great length, "that the left shies away from. In part, because in his view, it would mean throwing into question all hopes and dreams of building a stronger social safety net or slowing climate change." This was the global dollar system. Worldwide use of the dollar to settle international transactions and of American bonds as a trusted means for the world's central banks to store their currency reserves allows the American government to spend far beyond its revenues. Secure in the knowledge that financial markets will act as a credit card with an almost infinite limit. This has allowed America to spend $31 trillion more than it has taken in since the end of the Cold War. Because America's military dominance and stable government serve as guarantees. This system, Bannon warned in a series of pamphlets titled The End of the Dollar Empire, electronically published in collaboration with his show's main sponsor, the precious metals broker Birch Gold, was falling apart. Not quickly, but inevitably. If the world actually does abandon the dollar, America's days as the world's great military power will come to an abrupt end. NATO summits are carefully staged public spectacles. Most of the details of military aid and long-term strategic plans had been negotiated via back channels long before the delegations and heads of state arrived in July. Security was tight to the point of absurdity. Hordes of reporters from all over the world had come to cover it. Then almost everyone spent their time cut off from the real proceedings. Taping spots and waiting around in a massive hall set up as a media center. Before the official start of the conference, outgoing NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg gave a press conference with Kaja Kallas, the Prime Minister of Estonia, who has become a hero and an unlikely celebrity as she set her little Baltic nation to prepare itself for war. Estonia leads by example, Stoltenberg said. As one of only a handful of NATO members to devote more than 3% of its gross domestic product to military spending. The alliance's agreed minimum target for defense spending is 2% of GDP, compared to 3% for the U.S., which has an economy almost as large as all of Europe's. Until recently, very few members actually met the 2% target, leading former President Donald Trump to repeatedly question why America spends so much to guarantee Europe's security and to threaten to let Russia do whatever the hell they want to countries that chose to rely on America. That comment sent shockwaves around the world. "We are making real progress," Stoltenberg later told the press. And throughout the summit, he proudly cited the fact that now 23 of the 32 NATO member countries have met the minimum. Europe is bracing for war and for a future in which America can no longer be trusted to guarantee its security. The war in Ukraine has made painfully clear to the West that money alone doesn't translate to the kind of raw power it takes to win a full-scale war between modern armies. As our economy became more and more financialized and our manufacturing moved to China, Western leaders began to wake up to a broader crisis of production, which in America has become apparent from the fact that China has 230 times the military shipbuilding capacity of the United States, to the fact that the few U.S. factories producing 155-millimeter artillery shells proved incapable of meeting Ukraine's needs. Some policy experts here argue that we need to spend far more, 6% of GDP even, to rapidly rebuild our defense, guarantee our security to allies from South Korea to Eastern Europe, and prepare for a possible two-front war with Russia and China. The problem is that we really have no way to afford that kind of spending unless we restructure how we pay for benefits like Medicare and Social Security, or add further to our spiraling debt. Europe faces similar impossible decisions. After I checked in, I got a text asking if I'd like to visit the small Alexandria house that J.D. Vance calls home when he's in Washington. When I got there, he was drinking whiskey with a small circle of friends and aides as he relaxed on the couch in sweats and socks with yellow ducks on them. The meeting was off the record, but I am a journalist, one who has written about Vance, and so I could not help but whisper a prayer that Trump would happen to call and I'd be there to witness Vance being asked to join the ticket. A moment that, win or lose, would mark one of the most significant choices of a running mate in American history. From a systemic perspective, there are really only two things in politics that really mean something. Jeremy Carl, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior in the Trump administration, told me later. Elon Musk buying Twitter, he said, meaning that the right now had an unfiltered channel, and for someone to emerge who could make the MAGA into something bigger than the man Trump himself. This is what a potential Vance pick would really represent. Long ago, Vance told me that the first political book he ever read was The Death of the West by Pat Buchanan, and that the book still shapes his thinking. I bought and read it after he told me this, and I was surprised to find that it presaged almost perfectly the populist upswelling at the time Vance had just entered the primary for his Ohio U.S. Senate seat. It raised alarms about declining Western birth rates and globalization, and argued that immigration was sapping America's character and social cohesion. Western elites, Buchanan wrote in the introduction, do not seem to care if the end of the West comes by depopulation, by a surrender of nationhood, or by drowning in waves of third world immigration. Buchanan was dismissed as a paleocon when he ran for president in 1992 and 1996. But when Bannon took over as Trump's campaign chief in 2016, he made Trump's closing argument a very Buchananite message. The campaign's final TV ad, released 3 days before the election, was laughed off by many observers as a bizarre 2 minutes. The establishment has trillions of dollars at stake in this election, Trump said. The ad introduced an idea that's now almost a cliche on the online right, which has shaped the worldview of younger conservatives like Vance. You aren't a citizen of a nation, the line goes. You're an imperial subject. The next day, I attended a so-called defense industry forum where the heads of some of the world's biggest arms contractors sat on panels sharing their opinion that the West needed to quickly and drastically increase its purchases of war materials. Perhaps this was naive, but I had expected to hear people at least pay lip service to the idea that leaders might try to step back from a spiraling geostrategic competition that has us just on the brink of World War III. As a former counterterrorism official in the second George W. Bush administration had said to me, and I'm not trying to be alarmist, there was something slightly surreal about hearing all this talk of uncompromising, bloody resolve coming from the highest leaders of NATO. They overwhelmingly tend to be on the older side of middle age, svelte and nerdy looking, with airs more of modernist architects or math professors than managers of war. Stoltenberg, a former Norwegian prime minister, was set to retire as secretary general soon after the summit. I watched as Biden extolled his service at an evening gala as he fastened the Presidential Medal of Freedom on Stoltenberg's tall, thin shoulders. His replacement as the face of the alliance was to be the liberal former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, cast in much the same mold. He definitely fits the role, I heard Francis Farrell, a reporter for the Kyiv Independent, say before he became official that Rutte had the job. The tall, spectacled Northern European, who's just very clean and on point. At the press security checkpoint, I ran into Keith Gessen, the Russian-American writer, co-founder of the literary journal In and One, and the younger brother of M. Gessen, one of the world's most influential critics of the Putin regime. I asked Keith what he was making of a gathering where the world's most powerful people had agreed that Russia remains the most serious, immediate, and long-term threat. As Kallas, the Estonian PM, had put it to me, I'm not sure what I think, he said. He told me he'd been down at the NATO Public Forum, a sideshow put on in collaboration with think tanks like the Atlantic Council, which was, despite the name, entirely closed to the public. He talked with some Ukrainians who expressed the grim view that few leaders were willing to admit to in public. There's a ceasefire mood going around, they'd said. Ukrainian leaders were now supposedly looking to hold negotiations in Saudi Arabia. It wasn't supposed to work out this way. When Biden gave his 2022 speech announcing the war in Ukraine as an epical fight to save our world order, He had bragged that America had leveraged its power over world commerce in a new kind of economic statecraft with the power to inflict damage that rivals military might. He promised to reduce the ruble to rubble and that Russia would see an economic catastrophe. But Russia's economy has been growing faster than that of any country still in the American system. The sanctions ended up having the unintentionally seismic effect of showing that a major power could be kicked out of the dollar-based financial system without facing calamity. This was possible in theory because the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve have, for the last few decades, played a unique role in the geopolitical power structure. It's very complicated for a Japanese automaker selling cars in Mexico to go on the market and trade yens for pesos. So 58% of foreign transactions are settled in dollars, even when the trade has nothing to do with the United States. During the early post-World War II era, dollars were backed by gold, but that system fell apart in 1971. When France sent a ship to New York and demanded that the U.S. hand over the physical gold representing its holdings. It turned out that America's gold vaults at Fort Knox were actually too small. So President Richard Nixon arranged a deal with Saudi Arabia under which the kingdom agreed to exchange its oil solely in dollars, which didn't exactly mean that the value of the dollar was pegged to oil, but it did establish a guarantee that foreign creditors and central banks would be able to exchange dollars for the commodity that powered the entire world economy. Dollars became America's greatest export. This kept the value of our currency high and allowed the U.S. government to debt finance itself by selling treasury bonds on international markets. But there was a cost. The strength of the dollar made goods and commodities produced in America's real economy expensive and hurt its competition in the emerging global marketplace. This is the system that obsesses Bannon, but it's hardly just right-wingers who talk about it. It benefits financial industry elites, the center-left economist Yaakov Feigen wrote in an influential paper in 2020, who reap the rewards of intermediating capital inflows into U.S. markets, while the cost of non-tradable services like tuition, health care, and real estate rises for everyone else. Outside the U.S., governments of poorer countries often suppress local wages and run trade surpluses so they can stockpile dollars. All these trade imbalances feed returns, yet again, to global capital holders. Across all countries, Feigen wrote, elites win. The dollar system created a perverse dual incentive for the American military that sustains the system. It lets us finance huge expenditures on hyper-complex weapons and allows us to toss off hundreds of billions of dollars to support Ukraine's and Israel's wars. What about the weapons? I would soon hear a kafia-wearing pro-Palestine delegate shout from the floor of the Democratic National Convention during Kamala Harris's acceptance speech. There's a growing realization in the U.S. across the entire political spectrum that this system of geopolitical control now operates to some degree on autopilot. But it also allowed for wasteful spending and a hollowing out of the industrial base needed to produce simple war materiel like the artillery shells and air defense munitions that the armed forces of Ukraine so desperately need. And the weaponization of the dollar failed spectacularly because Russia still had lots of farms and factories capable of producing real goods. So being cut off from Western markets didn't lead to mass shortages. A new danger emerged that other powers would learn from the Russian example. Keith and I joined a crowd of journalists in a windowless room where Stoltenberg and Zelensky were giving a quick talk. Stoltenberg repeated a vague phrase that had become a buzzword at the summit, that NATO was committed to an irreversible path for Ukraine to join the alliance, even if Russia was unlikely to accept a peace deal without a commitment for Ukraine to stay out. We sat with Simon Schuster, a Time senior correspondent who'd written a biography of Zelensky titled The Showman, and who has reported uncomfortable facts about war fatigue and high-level corruption in Ukraine that many Western reporters have been reluctant to. "Are they going to shoot you when you walk in?" Keith joked. After the question period, Keith asked Schuster what he'd seen that we might not have picked up on. "Zelensky is very angry," Schuster told us. "I wouldn't be surprised if they'd had a fight back there right before they came on stage." I asked him what an irreversible path to NATO membership actually meant. He shrugged. "Nothing is irreversible," he said. Keith, thinking of the American president who was supposed to be the face of this whole event, gave a wry look. "Well," he said, "nothing but time." I had a card in my pocket, which I ended up being able to trade. I was pretty sure that Vance would be Trump's pick. My confidence had nothing to do with anything I'd learned from Vance himself. It came from years of increasing familiarity with the worldview of people like Bannon and of the young, weightlifting-obsessed men who make up the infantry of the America First movement. Trump may well have liked the idea of choosing a middle-of-the-road pro-internationalist Republican. But, as Bannon had once told me, Trump is an effing moderate compared to the people who have made him into a symbol of systemic reckoning, and I had trouble imagining that they'd stand for someone like North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, who by all appearances would be confused by the idea that the extent of America's financial and military power is sapping the vitality of the nation. I spoke to Bannon during the intra-Republican battle over who would succeed Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. Bannon argued that this, too, was a fight about the dollar system and the world order. "The whole civil war on Capitol Hill right now," he said then, "that's a real fight about money and power, about whether you can keep laying debt on the American people." I had never really thought of someone like Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, who comes off mostly as a MAGA culture warrior, as an anti-imperialist renegade. But to Bannon, it was all linked. Even populist Democrats are neoliberal neocons, a phrase he loves to use to dismiss any politician who doesn't show an interest in unknitting order. "To be serious, you've got to be anti-imperial," Bannon said dismissively of Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut I was then writing about, who actually shares many traditionalist-sounding critiques of how our connected world has left a void of meaning in people's lives. Bannon said he's out there supporting a $100 billion supplemental for Israel and Ukraine that we absolutely can't afford. Empire is the core mode of power. Unless you're prepared to take on Wall Street and the banks, which for Bannon would mean confronting the very basics of the financial system, you're never going to actually do anything. It's all talk. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.